Right, so the lecture is called Women Patrons of the Arts in Early Modern Europe, and that's what I will be talking about, but in a sense it's a kind of two for the price of one lecture, because we're going to talk about women, or maybe we'll think about it as gender, and that's something that we may be exploring, I think, next term in one of our tutorials. But I'm also going to talk about patronage. So I'm talking about patronage within the context of women and gender, but I think in a way you could probably use both of those concepts separately in other sort of situations. So I'm trying to sort of do two things at once, and I hope it will work. We'll see. Okay, good. Let's get going. I might actually, is it right if I try even to dim it a bit more? Because a lot of the paintings and things we see are quite dark. And is that all right still? Yeah, I think you get a better sense of what some of these images look like. Right. So before I start talking about women patrons, I just wanted to make a few comments about patronage in general. But to keep your eyes occupied while I'm doing that, I wanted to show you here on the right a portrait of a woman patron, and on the left, the self-portrait of an artist who painted her, and who unusually was herself a woman as well, namely the late 16th century Italian artist Lavinia Fontana. But first, a few words about the patron in general. There are many assumptions that we as 21st century beholders make about art. Perhaps one of the most persistent ones is that artists always have and always will use the works they produce to express their own personal thoughts, feelings, interests, and concerns. This probably sounds a bit familiar from the tutorials we had earlier this week. Now, we could debate whether this is wholly true even in the present day, but it was certainly not the case in the period I will be focusing on in this lecture, namely the early modern period, or what art historians usually refer to as the Renaissance and Baroque. Although the artist was clearly important, indeed even essential, in the production of artworks in this period, nevertheless, one could argue that for much of this time, it was the patron who was the initiator of almost all significant artistic projects, and that it was the patron who determined an individual artwork's most important features and characteristics, including what material it was made of, where it was displayed, what subject it depicted, its size, and even to a certain extent its design, style, and composition. Indeed, simply by selecting one artist rather than another in the first place, a patron was already making a key decision about what the final work would look like. Francis Haskell, who was the second professor of history of art here at Oxford, wrote an important book on painters and their patrons in the early modern period, in which he raised a key issue in patronage studies when he asked, quote, "Should my concern with patrons be determined by the intrinsic interest of their personalities and tastes, or by the quality and importance of the art they commissioned? For the two do not always coincide." In other words, one could in theory write a very interesting history of patrons that was illustrated with quite uninteresting works of art. And conversely, some very interesting artworks may have had rather uninteresting, or perhaps now unknown, patrons. So as art historians, we will inevitably have to decide on a case-by-case basis just how relevant it is to consider the patronage of a particular work, and whether to devote proportionally more attention to the patron, the artist, or the art object itself in our writings. Although the role of the patron in the early modern period in particular is clearly crucial, we must also keep in mind another point made by Haskell, namely, the dangers of assuming that knowing about a patron explains everything about a work of art, or better, explains exactly why a completed work looks the way it does. Nevertheless, understanding a patron's circumstances can provide us with important insights into why a particular work was commissioned, and in some cases can suggest, if never fully explain, why it has some qualities and characteristics but not others. These issues have particular relevance in the case of women patrons, who will be the focus of my talk today. Although many of their habits and concerns as patrons parallel those of their male contemporaries, the important differences between being a female rather than a male patron in early modern Europe serve to highlight important features about the nature of artistic patronage in general. In other words, by considering women patrons, we gain new insights into the very practice of patronage itself, since it is only by comparing women patrons to their male contemporaries that the often gender-specific assumptions underlying patronage studies come to light. This is a point that Linda Knopfler made in an influential article first published in the early 1970s and entitled, "Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists?" Although, as her title suggests, her focus was on women artists, not patrons, her basic point remains true. Namely, that the very fact that women, whether as artists or patrons, were clearly outsiders or exceptions to the rule in the early modern period, means that examining the art of this period through the lens of women can provide us with a new understanding of the insiders, of the male patrons and artists who stood at the very center of early modern culture, as well as allows us to begin to question some of the central assumptions art historians have made about the nature of art patronage itself in this period and throughout history. But now, finally, it's time to start looking at some real women patrons. So, the first question we have to ask is exactly who were the women who commissioned works of art and architecture in the early modern period? Interestingly enough, by far the largest number of women whose patronage can be documented in this period were widows, like the lady whose portrait we've been looking at on the right, or nuns, like those depicted kneeling in the image on the left, who either commissioned works as a group or who acted through the person of the abbess, the leader of a particular convent or female religious community. And this is a patron saint, and here you have various nuns. Some of them are what are called lay nuns, who are ones who are not sort of fully professed within the community, and so without sign, and others who are actually part of the community. But in any case, these are the nuns who were the patrons of the work we're looking at here. And incidentally, this picture of nuns at prayer was, like the portrait of the widow on the right, also made by a woman artist. Although in this case, in the one on the left, it was produced by an unknown 15th century German nun who was herself part of the community depicted in the image. The reasons for the prevalence of widows and nuns as patrons of the arts is quite simple. Only these women had the financial, legal, and social independence to pay for works of art themselves. As a young girl or married lady, a woman was legally and financially under the control of first her father and then her husband. Indeed, it was only if a married woman outlived her husband that she could finally decide whether and how to spend her money on commissioning works of art. Likewise, until joining a convent, a young nun would have been unable to exercise any kind of independent artistic patronage within her family home. Only upon joining a female religious community could collective decisions about commissioning art and architecture be made, although in many cases it was the abbess who was in overall charge of any such projects. But just how truly independent were even nuns and widows? And conversely, just how dependent were married women on their husbands? In the case of widows, especially younger ones, both their own birth families and those of their deceased husbands could often try to exert influence on a widow's art patronage decisions. In the case of nuns, many convents and religious orders abided by customs and statutes that meant they were overseen both legally and financially by the male branch of their order or by secular male advisors. But this raises a key question about studying female patronage in general, namely, how do we know when and how this actually occurred? I don't know if you picked up, but I did say that the largest number of documented women patrons in this period were widows or nuns. But what about the undocumented impact women had on artistic patronage? And do documents tell us everything about the decisions that were actually made when commissioning works of art? So, for instance, even if an abbess had to obtain the approval of a high-ranking male priest before commissioning an artist to paint an altarpiece for her convent, does the signed payment record alone necessarily confirm that the abbess and the nuns she oversaw weren't actively involved in deciding which artist to choose or which subject to depict in the first place? So in other words, you know, we need to question even documents. It says, so-and-so paid for this altarpiece. Well, paying is not always the same as necessarily deciding and commissioning and thinking about what's going to be depicted and who might be doing a good job about it. Similarly, the fact that most of the official contracts and payment records relating to the art patronage of someone like the 16th century Florentine ruler Cosimo de' Medici were signed or approved by him alone, so the paperwork's always sort of in his name, but that does not necessarily mean that his wife, Eleonora da Toledo, who you see here with one of her sons, might not have had quite a lot to say about who was hired and what works were actually made. In fact, the art historian Roger Crum, and I think that may be on your reading list there in the handout, Roger Crum has put it this way. If a future scholar who looked only at signed checks or who paid the bills in many of our own present-day families, looking, 100, 200, 1,000 years from now in our own family records, that historian might well assume that all the decisions about how to, say, decorate the living room or what pictures to hang on the walls of our homes had been made by the male head of the household. Whereas in reality, it might be the wife or mother who was the one who had actually chosen the furniture picked the color scheme and selected the artworks. And Roger Cumm in his piece says, you know, if anyone, I mean, he was talking about his own family, he said, you know, it would look like my father had been the one who had made all the decorating decisions because he pays all the bills, but, you know, my dad has absolutely nothing to say with, you know, what's hung over the sofa or what color the sofa is or whatever it might be. But in a sense, if you look just at the document records, even of something very contemporary like Roger Crumb's family, you might well get a very skewed view of who was actually, in a sense, doing what we might think of as the more interesting side of the patronage, making the decisions. So just the bills and the signed documents don't always tell the whole story. And in fact, in the case of early modern married women, who much more than today were legally and financially dependent on their husbands, it is thus often too simplistic to say that they had no influence on even major artistic or architectural commissions just because we don't have a trail of signed documents to follow up. But if we do stick to documented commissions, it becomes clear that, at least in the secular sphere, the most common types of projects undertaken by women on their own related to the tombs of their deceased husbands. Early modern widows were exhorted to follow the classical model of Artemisia, the ancient widowed queen whose fabulous tomb for her husband, King Mausolus, became one of the seven wonders of the ancient world and in fact gives us the word mausoleum. Like Artemisia, early modern widows were also often concerned first, foremost, and often only, with commissioning an appropriate funerary monument for their husbands. Some monuments, like the one on the right, included an effigy of the deceased spouse, in this case, a prominent Paduan lawyer. And I hope you can see in line here, there's actually another version of him on the other side, because it's a kind of double-sided tomb that you could look at either side. And I think he's supposed to be his little student acolyte, so I expect you all to be gathered around my tomb in the future, because he was a sort of an academic as well as a lawyer, so you've got his little assistants and students there around his tomb. The other, on the left, was for a Florentine nobleman, Antonio Strozzi, which included sculpted saints, but no image of the husband. Sculpted effigies of women were very rare, although wives did sometimes appear as kneeling donors together with their husbands in painted altarpieces commissioned for funerary chapels. However, even if a widow did not make a personal appearance in her husband's funerary chapel, she could remind posterity of her role as a patron through an inscription, or in the case of the Strozzi tomb on the left, by including her own coat of arms as well as that of her spouse in the project. But showing you these two slides of, all things considered, two fairly uninteresting tombs raises some rather more interesting general issues. Because as you can see, they're actually quite different in terms of style, in terms of whether they include an effigy of the deceased, even in terms of the kind of stone that has been selected. And I'm afraid if you saw these in color, I think, which I don't have any colors, but you can see, you know, they're different also in terms of their colors and all sorts of other things. And this raises an important question about women patrons in general. Namely, just how significant was the fact that they were women to the final appearance of the works they commissioned? In the case of these two tombs, they look, in fact, much more like tombs commissioned by male patrons in the same cities at the same time than they look like one another. So we need to be careful not to attribute all or even some of the differences we see between tombs or any other artworks commissioned by women primarily to the gender of the patron. Indeed, other factors are often much more important. For instance, differences in regional styles, the availability of certain materials, family traditions, or even when works were made. In this case, they're about 100 years apart, so that may explain more of the differences than the fact that, or than any kind of possible similarities of theirs by being made commissioned by women. So one must think carefully before claiming that it is only or even mainly because the patron was a woman that a particular work of art looks the way it does. Perhaps even more crucial is to keep in mind the fact that, for the most part, the artworks commissioned by early modern female patrons that survive to this day are those associated with very wealthy elite women. Yes, there are a few scattered documentary references to the wives of bakers or stonemasons commissioning commemorative monuments for their husbands, but almost all such works have now disappeared and would, in any case, have been restricted primarily to small commemorative plaques, not life-size effigies or entire decorated chapels, as in the examples we see here. So it was a secular woman's elite status, rather than her gender, that was probably the single most important factor in determining whether she was able to commission significant works of art and architecture in the first place, something that, of course, is true for elite male patrons as well. So, one of the questions to keep in mind when talking about women patrons is the extent to which gender actually is a factor. Or in other words, is there such thing as a typically female style of patronage, either in terms of what kinds of things were commissioned, or in terms of their style and iconography? As we shall see, the answer is, it depends. For the rest of this talk, I would like to look at three women from the very top of the social, political, and economic hierarchy. One a marchioness, the other two queens, in order to try to tease out what differences, if any, it made that they were female rather than male patrons. The first case I want to consider is the woman you see in these two portraits, Isabella d'Este, the marchioness of Mantua, a small but influential town in northern Italy, dominated by the ruling Gonzaga family in this period. Unusually, Isabella was a wife, not a widow, and her very active patronage of artists, as well as her insatiable collecting habits, are extremely well documented by the more than 12,000 letters she wrote and 28,000 letters she received between 1490 and her death in 1539. And we're talking about almost a level of kind of emails bouncing back and forth. If you start to divide 12,000 letters by her and 28,000 letters to her, and those are just the ones that have survived, there may well have been even more. So we know quite a lot. And in fact, we know from these letters that, like her elite male contemporaries, she tried to buy the best antiquities she could afford and tried to hire the foremost artists of the day to work for her. So, for instance, she sought out artists such as Leonardo, Giorgione, Giovanni Bellini, and Raphael, but never was able to get any of them to paint her, although Leonardo did draw her portrait, which you see on the left. And there's an interesting copy, I don't know, it's a little bit ambiguous what it is, but there's an interesting second version made right very soon after this one in 1500 that actually hangs now in the print room in the Ashmolean Museum. So next time you're in the print room, have a look around and you can see the sort of second version of this Leonardo one. This one is the one that's in the Louvre. However, despite Mantua, the city where she married into the family and became part of the ruling family in Mantua, despite Mantua's relative poverty and fairly minor political status in the grand scheme of things, Isabella did manage to get artists such as Perugino, Mantegna, and Correggio to work for her. So she didn't get the painted portrait by Leonardo or the Raphael or the Giovanni Bellini or the Giorgione, but she did get Perugino, Mantegna, and Correggio, and she amassed a truly impressive collection of antique works on what other aristocrats would have considered to be a shoestring budget. And Isabella's desire for big-name artists and classical objects were, in fact, very similar to those of her elite male contemporaries, including her own brother, Alfonso d'Este, who ruled her hometown of Ferrara. So there are ways that she's quite similar to other male patrons of the period, but the fact that she was an elite woman patron does seem to have had an impact on the iconography she favored in her artistic commissions, if not the types of works she tried to commission or the particular artists she tried to hire. Thus, while elite male contemporaries commissioned portraits that emphasized their wisdom as well as their military and political power, as seen in Titian's portrait on the left of the Duke of Urbino in armor, Isabella's portrait by the same artist, that is by Titian, on the right, makes visual references to typically female ideals of beauty and behavior. For instance, unlike the Duke, Isabella doesn't brazenly look us directly in the eye, as befits a virtuous married woman. She also has perfect white skin, luminous eyes, an elaborate yet still decorously covered hairdo, and expensively elegant clothing. The fact that she was actually 60 years old when this particular portrait was painted, however, suggests that well before Botox and plastic surgery, a little bit of strategic airbrushing was an essential skill for an artist to commission to depict such a woman. Although Titian presumably also flattered his male sitters by making them look more wise and powerful than they perhaps actually were, we are probably safe in assuming that making a male sitter look like a pretty young teenager is something that he aimed for only when painting women. She looks good for 60, I think. Yeah, not bad at all. Gender may have also played a role in the kinds of subjects that Isabella chose and how she interacted with the artists she hired. In fact, some scholars have actually criticized Isabella for being a meddling and over-controlling patron, especially in relation to the artist she hired to decorate her studiolo in Mantua's Ducal Palace, the room you see here on the right, which she used to display her collection of art and antiquities. And there are actually reproductions of some of the paintings she had around here. She had another little room next to it called the Grotta, where she kept lots of her sort of collected objects. There would be sort of two little rooms. And you get this sort of very strange, and really from quite recent scholars, who are saying, typical woman, I mean, you know, people say this, typical woman, always meddling, always fussing, you know, just leave the man alone, let him get on with the art. I mean, you sort of get this kind of rhetoric from quite recent writers, which I find a bit surprising. However, from her letters, we can see that she did, in fact, try very hard to make sure that artists like Perugino, whose painting for Isabella Studiolo you see on the left, that they stuck to her very detailed instructions. In this case, Perugino, she specified to him not only that the subject of the painting should show an allegorical combat between erotic love and chaste love, but also gave detailed written instructions along the lines of, and I'm going to quote just a tiny bit of this very long letter where she says all the things that are supposed to be happening in this picture, quote, the goddesses Pallas Athena and Diana should be depicted fighting vigorously against Venus and Cupid, and Pallas Athena should seem almost to have vanquished Cupid, having broken his golden bow and cast a silver bow underfoot. With one hand she is holding him by the bandage which the blind boy has before his eyes, and with the other she is lifting her lance and about to kill him, and on and on and on and on. With Isabella not only giving the artist a detailed drawing of what the entire composition should look like, but even at one point sending a piece of string to indicate exactly how tall the largest figure in the painting should be. Because she wanted, the paintings were made by different artists in this room, and she wanted to make sure that they were sort of proportionally right. So she sends a little piece and she says, you know, I'm wrapping this letter up with a piece of string so that the tallest figure is, you know, this big. So pretty detailed, pretty hands-on. In contrast, scholars have been much more praising of a highly similar project by Isabella's brother, Alfonso d'Este. This project was actually inspired by his sister's ambitious Studiolo, which was decorated not just in the case of Alfonso with Perugino's, the Studiolo by Isabella was decorated not just with Perugino's painting, but works by other well-known artists. In imitation of this, Alfonso d'Este also commissioned famous artists to decorate his own Studiolo in Ferrara. One of the pieces is the work you see here, Titian's painting of the classical tale of Bacchus and Ariadne, now in the National Gallery in London. In comparison to Isabella, Alfonso maintained a very hands-off policy towards his artists. Once he had selected Titian and had pointed the artist to the classical text that he was to illustrate it, Alfonso seems to have just let the painter get on with the job as he best saw fit, thereby confirming his own status as a forward-thinking and broad-minded patron who valued the artist's own initiative and innate genius. I say that in quotes. Modern scholars, using modern or contemporary notions about art being the expression of an artist's own ideas, have thus inevitably preferred Titian's painting to the one produced by Perugino, because that Titian's expressing his own genius as an artist, whereas Perugino is kind of how you can buckle under this sort of meddling female patron. But if we look at these works from the point of view of the early modern patron, and in light of the patron's gender in particular, we gain a better understanding of why they look the way they do, and why a woman patron such as Isabella may have wanted to control her artists so closely, even at the expense of their own self-expression. As a woman, she simply didn't have the freedom, in the context of early modern social expectations, to just let the painter get on with the job. Instead, she had to make sure that the final result wouldn't reflect badly on her own reputation as an educated but also chaste and decorous woman. So rather than going directly to a classical text, which is what her brother does in his painting that he commissions, she instead decided that she had to concoct her own subject by using classical figures, such as Venus, Cupid, Diana, and Athena, but then setting them into a moralizing tale of her own invention, in which chastity always triumphs over mere erotic sexual attraction. A most appropriately ladylike theme, but one that inevitably had to be carefully explained to the artist in order to avoid any embarrassing misunderstandings in the final image. So in other words, she has other constraints. She is meddling, but there's a reason. Because as a woman, she doesn't want to have the pictures possibly misinterpreted. And in fact, Isabella's anxieties were not just based on unfounded paranoia, as demonstrated by one of the other paintings she commissioned for a Studiolo, an image for which she did not provide quite so detailed instructions. The painting in question is the one you see here, a work by Mantegna showing Venus and Mars ruling over the Muses on Mount Parnassus. Apparently, some viewers misread the image as including a portrait of Isabella herself in the figure of Venus up at the top, who, although she is clearly supposed to be very beautiful, was also depicted completely in the nude. Not at all an appropriate association for a high-ranking lady very concerned about her public image. So by considering the paintings by Perugino, Mantegna, and Titian in terms of the gender of their respective patrons, we gain a better understanding of why each looks the way it does and how the gendered concerns of each patron played at least some role in the final result. In the case of Isabella, by reflecting her worries about commissioning works that might cause scandal and embarrassment, while in the case of Alfonso, allowing the patron to show off his knowledge of the original classical sources and his far-sightedness in giving a famous artist such as Titian a relatively free hand, something that was much more difficult for a female patron in Isabella's position to do. Thus, without understanding the cultural constraints and expectations under which both male and female patrons operated in the early modern period, one would have only an incomplete understanding of the works they commissioned. The problems of devising an appropriate iconography for a female patron were even more acute a century later, in the case of Maria de' Medici, the second of our three case studies, who you see in these two portraits, one as a young mother, the one on the right, and on the left a slightly worse for wear widow. Unlike Isabella d'Este, who quite unusually was married during her most active phase as a collector and art patron, Maria was a widow by the time of her most prolific period of patronage. As her surname suggests, Maria de' Medici was part of the famous Florentine Medici family. But she had married the King of France, Henry IV, in 1600 and moved to Paris. Henry, however, had become king only by agreeing to convert to Catholicism and then annulling the marriage to his first Protestant wife. So when Maria arrived, she was particularly concerned with asserting her status as the king's legitimate and very Catholic wife, and equally importantly, as the mother of his legitimate and very Catholic children. Not surprisingly, right from the start, Maria emphasized both her religion, through her patronage of Catholic churches and convents, and her legitimacy, as seen in images like the printed portrait on the right, made soon after the birth of her first son, the future King Louis XIII, in which an anagram of her name is meant to read, is made to read, "Je me dis la mère d'un roi," I call myself the mother of a king. It's this little, you can see the person who owned this print, so she's got Marie de Médicis wine, it's a kind of old-fashioned French way of saying queen, and then she takes the words and kind of changes them and says, "Je me dis la mère d'un roi," and the mother of a king, and somebody here has obviously done all these little X's. They're saying, okay, M, yeah, she's the M, A, yeah, there's the A, where's the R, there are. So someone sort of like ticked it off and said, oh yeah, it works, cool, anagram. In any case, the point of that was not just the anagram, but it was, you know, emphasizing her role as the kind of mother of the king, the legitimate mother of the king. However, her fairly low-key use of visual propaganda while living in the shadow of her charismatic husband, this came to a dramatic end in 1610, so they'd been married 10 years at that point, when just one day after her official crowning as Queen of France, she's only crowned, coronated Queen of France a decade after her marriage, and of course after she's produced lots of little babies, which is what you're supposed to do if you're a good queen. Any case, one day after her official crowning as Queen of France, Henry was murdered by a religious fanatic, leaving Maria as the Queen Regent, since her son, Louis, was still too young to rule on his own. Suddenly, Maria was in charge, not just of the country, but also of all royal artistic patronage. And, like a good widow, she immediately started planning her husband's tomb, as you can see in this drawing, which includes an equestrian portrait of the king at the very top of an elaborate monument. But this project was never completed, something for which she was increasingly criticized by jealous political rivals at the French court. Instead, Maria began an entirely new project, the Luxembourg Paris, which you see here in an early bird's eye view and which still dominates the Luxembourg Gardens in central Paris to this day. Has anyone seen the Luxembourg Gardens or been to Luxembourg Gardens? That big, it's the big palace at one end of it, is the Luxembourg Palace that Maria commissions. Significantly, Maria herself referred to this massive building not at the time as the Luxembourg Palace, but as the Medici Palace in her personal correspondence. And interestingly enough, she combined a typically French ground plan for a palace in which two wings jut out from a central core with a pavilion at the front. So this is sort of a typical French palace plan. So you've got the main building, these two wings, and this kind of thin, thin facade, basically, at the front. That's combined
with detailing that was very much recalling her own Italian, so not French, but Italian palace that she grew up in, the Pitti Palace in Florence. I don't know, have any of you seen that? Okay. It's got very big, what's called rusticated, that kind of rough stonework, and you can't see it so much in this print, but a lot of the exterior of the Luxembourg Palace has that kind of rough stonework called rustication, which is something not typically French, but quite typically Italian, in particular, sort of her home when she grew up as a little girl in the Pitti Palace in Florence. This thereby visually blended the culture into which she had married with her own native traditions, something that a male patron of her rank, of course, would have never wanted or needed to do, because he would have sort of been in his own tradition and stayed there. Men didn't go out to marry and live in other countries or other kingdoms. Perhaps even more interesting is the discussion some of her artistic advisors had about her plans to put up statues around the entrance dome to the palace, around this building here. Maria had apparently wanted to have these statues be figures representing famous wives and mothers from the past, thereby clearly hoping to link herself to these illustrious predecessors. But her suggestion to include Artemisia, the famous widow who had commissioned the mausoleum for her husband, was deemed to be a very bad idea by her advisors, since unlike the ancient queen, Maria had in fact not yet completed a suitably grand funerary monument for her own deceased husband. One of her advisors on this matter was the famous Flemish painter Peter Paul Rubens, and it was the paintings he produced for Maria that highlight just how complicated it was for a powerful widow in a delicate political situation to devise a visual iconography that was appropriate for her status and her gender. The problem can be summarized as follows. How could Rubens adapt the visual rhetoric he usually deployed for elite male patrons, which consisted of nude or semi-nude female allegorical figures? How could this be adapted to the very particular needs of a powerful female patron, who, like Isabella d'Este, could not afford to be associated with anything scandalous or indecorous? This was an especially acute problem for Maria, since she had hired Rubens in the early 1620s to paint a carefully edited version of her own life story in response to the recent falling out she had had with her now grown-up son Louis, who had by then assumed the throne for himself. Things had gotten so bad that at one point Maria had had to flee from Paris, and there had even been skirmishes between her son's troops and her own. And just imagine if it was sort of an army loyal to the queen, fighting an army loyal to Prince William. I mean, that would be a sort of, or Prince Charles, would be sort of an odd situation. And if you can think of that, you can imagine how tense the situation must have been in France at that time. After mother and son had sort of kissed and made up, though, Maria decided to commission Rubens to paint a cycle of 24 paintings for her new palace, the Luxembourg, illustrating her own life story, including the canvas you see here. So a kind of authorized, this is my side of the story kind of series. And again, some of you may have seen these in the Louvre. They're really massive paintings. I mean, significantly bigger than what you see there. I mean, I'd say taller even than this sort of whole wall. But made, as I said, originally for the Luxembourg Paris, but a big project. The series as a whole takes up a number of themes already encountered in the Queen Mother's artistic patronage, because, of course, by this time she's the Queen Mother, because her son is actually the King, because he's old enough now. So it takes up themes like her role as wife and mother, the legitimacy of her claims to power, and the history of the Medici family. At the same time, the difficulties involved in depicting a powerful woman are well demonstrated by the cycle of paintings, and despite her wishes to the contrary, these images were apparently unable to prevent a final rupture of the truce between Louis and the Queen Mother. Indeed, only 7 years after Rubens had finished the paintings, Maria was forced to flee France for good and had to live in exile until her death in 1642. One factor in the cycle's apparent lack of success as an act of visual propaganda may lie in the tensions between Rubens's pictorial language and the cycle's female subject, that is, Maria herself. These problems are well illustrated by examining some of the paintings in the series more closely. In The Education of Maria de' Medici, which you see here, for example, Rubens uses the nude graces as an attribute of the queen. And I'm sure, I hope, your eye was sort of immediately probably drawn to these kind of beautiful light figures. I'm not so sure whether you noticed that. That's actually Maria. Now, obviously, the graces were meant to attest to the queen's femininity. It is significant, however, that the young Maria is shown turning away from these women in order to devote her attention to the teachings of Minerva, the goddess of wisdom. And that's the sort of figure whose knee she kind of is leaning on. However, the male god Orpheus, seated in the left foreground, assumes the role of the implied male viewer by gazing directly at the seductive nude graces rather than at the future Queen of France. Orpheus thus demonstrates inadvertently how distracting Rubens's use of bare female bodies as allegorical figures could be to contemporary male viewers. Since the palace's most important visitors would have been male courtiers and, of course, her son, the king himself, such distractions from the main subject of the cycle, that is, Maria, had serious implications. The motif of the exposed female body, especially the exposed breast, occurs in several other paintings in the Medici cycle. In this painting, for instance, which depicts in highly allegorical terms Maria's first meeting with her husband, the queen, and this is the queen is kind of, it's Juno and Jupiter up in the sky, so they're sort of being very allegorized, but they're portraits, recognizable portraits of both Maria and her husband, her deceased, of course, husband by this point. In this painting, the queen looks humbly downwards while presenting her own bare breast to her husband as a symbol of her role as wife and future mother. The composition recalls images of the coronation of the Virgin Mary, Maria's holy namesake, which suggests that the queen's bare breast, like the Madonna's, should be understood as proof of her virtuous motherhood and of her status as an ideal bride. Bare breasts, however, could also have not just positive but also very negative associations in this period by alluding to the dangers of female seduction. In fact, early modern culture in general seems to have held very ambiguous views about the significance of the bare female breast. So the bare breast was clearly depicted as a positive attribute in images of the Virgin, such as Rubens' painting on the left of the Madonna and Child, with the Madonna's breast exposed there. But other texts and images stress the dangers of the exposed female breast. Evil women, such as the Old Testament figure of Delilah, seen here in another painting by Rubens now in the National Gallery in London, were often depicted using their bare breasts to seduce unwary men, in this case, the hero Samson. And so, I don't know if you know, this is the famous story of Samson Delilah, where he gets his hair cut off. Or the only way to make him lose his power is to have his hair cut off, so she's sent to seduce him by these sort of evil soldiers who are going to capture him. You see the servant just snipping off his hair. But, you know, how has she managed to lure this great hero, this great sort of Israelite hero? By her boobs, right? So, you know, they're out there, and that obviously did the trick. So, you know, this is a more worrying view of what the sort of dangerous powers of the bare female breast. By choosing to pair Maria de' Medici's symbolically bare breast with attributes normally associated with male power in several paintings in the cycle, Rubens could thus inadvertently have reminded viewers of the well-known theme of the dangerous power of women. In the portrait of Maria de' Medici as Queen Triumphant, which you see here, for example, Maria's exposed breast is juxtaposed with attributes such as helmets, armor, and cannons, attributes usually associated with powerful male warriors and rulers. Although Rubens's patron clearly wanted such images to act as positive evidence of Maria's ability to govern France and command its troops, contemporary fears about women using sexuality to gain power over men meant that these images could also have evoked very negative interpretations of the queen's real intentions. Interestingly enough, while Maria's abilities as a ruler were alluded to favorably in many texts published during her regency, she began to be described in increasingly unfavorable terms after her first falling out with her son. Now the queen mother was called, quote, deceitful, perfidious, and evil, and those are just some of the nicer things that were said about her. Although Rubens and Maria presumably intended the cycle's paintings to put a positive spin on her public image, their inability to control contemporary viewers' actual responses meant that male viewers in particular could have easily misinterpreted some of these images in very negative terms. Thus, despite her best intentions, Maria de' Medici's patronage of these paintings highlights how difficult it was to depict a woman as powerful without being threatening in the early modern period, a problem that Maria's male contemporaries would never have faced when they commissioned portraits or allegorical works to affirm their own power and status. The final woman patron that we'll consider today was equally preoccupied with carefully controlling her image by visual means. Unlike Isabella d'Este and Maria de' Medici, however, Queen Elizabeth I of England was neither a wife nor a widow, but rather that most exceptional thing of all, a single woman who was rich and powerful all on her own. But she too, like Maria de' Medici, was worried about confirming her legitimacy, in her case as the rightful and, in her case again, crucially Protestant heir of her father, Henry VIII, as well as about striking the right balance between asserting her power and avoiding any of the negative, gender-specific associations early modern culture made about a woman who tried to rule over men. Not surprisingly, some of the most important images she commissioned in the first part of her reign, after succeeding her half-sister Mary in 1558, made very clear references to her father. For instance, in this painting, known as the Allegory of the Tudor Succession, Elizabeth is shown being led to the king by goddesses symbolizing peace and plenty, as well as being accompanied by Henry's by-then-deceased young male heir, Edward VI, thus visually confirming Elizabeth as Henry's natural, legitimate, and divinely ordained heir. Significantly, and in contrast, her Catholic half-sister Mary is shown on the other side of Henry's throne, accompanied not only by her Catholic husband, King Philip of Spain, but also by the dangerous god of war, Mars, rather than by the auspicious goddesses visually linked to Elizabeth. So it's a bit of a dark painting. So here we have Mars leading in Mary with King Philip. And of course, this is bringing up a whole series of ideas of, well, you know, thank goodness she's not, I mean, this is what Elizabeth is saying, thank goodness she's not the queen, because she's not only ruling, she's not only Catholic and ruling in her own right, but she's married. And that's the whole problem of being the married queen, is that in a sense, who is really in charge of the country? Oh my goodness, it could be Spain and Catholics and, you know, all the terrible things that was implying at the time. Whereas here we have good, you know, Queen Elizabeth, you know, literally kind of in the right line to the male heir who dies, Edward. There's Elizabeth, and she's coming in with, you know, these good goddesses, not a horrible war, but peace and plenty and so forth. And of course, that's Henry in the center. So she's making very visible there, in some ways, the advantages of her not being married, but certainly, you know, confirming her legitimacy there as the king's Protestant and the better heir. But Elizabethan imagery changes from the early 1580s onwards, when it became clear that the queen, by then in her late 40s, would probably never marry, and more importantly, would probably never produce an heir to the throne. For it was at this time that she began to encourage her courtiers to commission paintings that had portrayed her more and more explicitly as a chaste, ever-virgin, and always youthful queen, as in this portrait celebrating Elizabeth's almost divine role in the English victory over the Spanish Armada in 1588. And here you see you know, the ships coming in, and then here is the storm that kind of wrecks the Spanish Armada. And there she is, right in the middle, as though she's kind of happening, you know, with her hand on the globe and all sorts of other nice kind of iconographic images there to show, you know, her sort of role in this. Like Catholicism's favorite virgin saint, the Madonna, whose cult the Protestant Elizabeth in some ways tried to replace with her own, the queen is draped in pearls, symbols of chastity. Likewise, the bow that remains very firmly tied right over her genital area, with a large pearl hanging beneath it, reminds us of her quasi-saintly virtue and eternal chastity. But despite such fairly blatant iconography, the style of this painting is curiously old-fashioned and archaizing, especially if one looks at her blank, expressionless face and the relentless piling up of iconographic attributes, all depicted without any sense of convincing space or three-dimensionality. The archaizing style of Elizabeth's portraits is especially noticeable if one compares them to those painted of her sister and immediate predecessor on the English throne, the Catholic Queen Mary. Mary was the wife of the Spanish king, and in images like the one on the left, used a relatively modern and continental, as well as naturalistic style for her much more three-dimensional portraits, even allowing a few wrinkles to show on her face. I mean, you know, all of you have talked about or been thinking about, you know, sort of style and comparisons of art, and you were thinking about both, and, you know, the style of progression of things. I don't think you would ever guess that this painting was actually later than that painting. I mean, this looks kind of more naturalistic, but I think that it's not just that, you know, English artists couldn't paint that well. I think it's also partly a very conscious choice of Queen Elizabeth to choose a kind of more old-fashioned style, a more non-continental, a more English style, and you can sort of think about the implications of that, why she might want to do that. Indeed, in contrast to Mary, Elizabeth favored an almost anti-naturalistic and archaizing style that recalled the iconic portraits painted of her father at the height of his power, more than half a century earlier, not the more modern and naturalistic style favored by her half-sister and the rival Spanish court. Similarly, full-length portraits like the one on the right, in which Elizabeth literally stands on a map of England, I think her feet are actually in Oxfordshire,
But seriously, because that's where the courtier who commissioned the painting, his home is in Oxfordshire, but she stands in Oxfordshire, so there. In these kind of portraits in which Elizabeth literally stands on the map of England, echoing the command, they echo the commanding presence her father assumed in his own full-length portraits like the one on the left. However, whereas Elizabeth resorts to a voluminous but beautifully decorated dress to assert her dominant status, while at the same time reaffirming her femininity, her father sports a prominent codpiece and happily shows off his powerful legs, thereby visually confirming his very masculine authority. Despite such gender-based difference, however, the overall aura of iconic power and timeless majesty is remarkably similar. But as her reign progressed, Elizabeth's portraits appeared to become increasingly frozen in time and in style, so that when this image was painted in the final years of her reign, she seems to have almost become a two-dimensional image. In this case, in this procession, her courtiers, with their spindly and emasculated legs, seem to be carrying a rectangular painted icon of the queen, rather than a real living being. I mean, I feel that this almost looks like they're carrying a certain picture of her, rather than, you know, a real figure. Indeed, if we didn't know that this was an English scene painted by an English painter, one could almost imagine that what was actually being carried was an iconic painted image of Elizabeth's Catholic opposite number, the Virgin Mary. And in fact, by the end of her reign, Elizabeth and her images had effectively become secular Protestant substitutes for the old Catholic cult of the Madonna. However, and interestingly, in most cases, the Queen herself didn't actually pay for or commission such paintings, instead encouraging her courtiers to sign the checks, so to speak. So should we even speak of her as a patron in the first place, since she didn't commission the paintings that we're talking about? I would argue yes, since she was very clearly, deployed a variety of strategies to try to control how she was represented in contemporary imagery. One method was to approve only a limited number of models that could be used to produce numerous authorized replicas, a cheap but effective way of having your wealthiest subjects project your intended image at their own expense, as seen in the various versions that were painted of the so-called Armada portrait. And you see here just two of the many examples that survive to this day, each with minor variations, but all clearly based on a single approved prototype. Even clearer evidence of the Queen's control of her own image is seen in the miniature portrait paintings that her subjects were encouraged to wear around their necks or pin on their clothes like sacred or talismanic charms, as seen in this example, still in its original case. We know from documents that Elizabeth controlled such images by pre-approving only certain portrait designs, designs that inevitably showed her as eternally young and divinely beautiful. Indeed, contemporaries refer to this look as Elizabeth's mask of youth. Just how artificial and carefully controlled Elizabeth's official public image had become by the last decade of her reign is suggested by the unusually candid drawing on the left of the Queen, age 60, that is, about 5 or 10 years younger than she was by the time of the officially approved portrait on the right was actually produced. So this seems to be a kind of sketch from life. It's very importantly a drawing. It's not a finished miniature, and the artists, in a sense, were encouraged, you know, okay, they might have taken a sitting of her, but they were trying to kind of morph this into the kind of eternal mask of youth. But as I said, that painting is actually done significantly after this one. You know, I would say she clearly looks much younger there, but that's the point, is that in kind of authorized things, not sort of unauthorized or sort of informal things like this, but in more authorized kinds of images, this cult of youth and eternal beauty, eternal chastity, continues. And of course, the importance of her internal life, in a sense, is that they're, you know, saying, don't worry about the fact that there's no heir, and there's going to be a lot of problems after that. No, she's going to live forever. She's the chaste virgin queen. So, even well into her 60s, Elizabeth continued to maintain the fiction that she was still young, beautiful, and implicitly fertile, thereby trying to reassure subjects visually that they shouldn't worry about who would succeed her. Of course, a fiction of eternal youth and beauty is something that we have already seen in Isabella d'Este's portrait, also age 60, but still looking as fresh and young as Elizabeth was in miniatures like the one on the right. Thus, once again, we see how women patrons shared at least some gender-specific concerns regarding age and beauty in the kinds of images they commissioned or approved. However, as I suggested at the start of this lecture, exploring how gender may have affected the works commissioned by women patrons also forces us to take another look at the art commissioned by men.
So we can now look at works such as these two portraits of the Habsburg Emperor Charles V by Titian in terms of how questions of gender may have affected the final result. For instance, by considering the very prominent symbols of masculinity in the painting on the right, such as once again a bulging codpiece and the faithful hunting dog. Or in the case of the image on the left, how earlier male role models, such as Roman emperors, who were also famously depicted on horseback in equestrian sculptures and also on coins, how these might have influenced the composition. And by doing so, we realize that, just like works associated with female patrons, such paintings can also be fruitfully assessed in terms of the gender of those who commission them. So by exploring an apparently marginal topic, such as women patrons, marginal at least in terms of overall numbers, it's not only interesting in its own right, but also makes us look anew at works produced for some of the key male figures of the period as well. But doing that, looking at that subject would be a topic for another lecture, but one which I'm relieved to say I won't be giving you today. Thank you very much.